Good evening. This is an interview for the Michigan Writers Series, Friday, November 21st, 2003. Speaking with Michael Steinberg, who recently published his memoir, Still Pitching, but growing up in 1950s New York. He's also a professor emeritus of American thought and language here at MSU. Welcome back, Dr. Steinberg.
Good to be here, Stephanie. Thanks.
Now, what do you have to say to folks who might label your book as just another coming-of-age story about boys and baseball?
Well, they'd be right, factually, that's true. Mm-hmm. But and it's true that everyone's coming-of-age story is kind of connected to everyone else's because of the just what being a child, what being an adult entails. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that's good because I want people to be able to connect with something that they didn't live through and that wasn't really a part of their world. And yet at the same time, the only one who can write your story is you, because you're the one that goes back to find out what happened and how it happened and why. And everyone will come up with a different version of his or her own mm-hmm. youth. And at the same time, those versions should be similar. Someone who didn't grow up in the 50s playing baseball shouldn't have a hard time relating to this to this story.
Well, as we were talking about on the way up here, of course, your book is about so much more than just baseball. I mean, it's really your adolescence as a whole and your transformation from a very, you know, insecure boy into a young man who is very sure of himself and hopefully his future, although I think you drifted a little after high school.
A lot.
Yeah, a lot. Well, in an essay you published in Fourth Genre, the literary mag you were the founding editor of, you wrote that the artfully crafted personal essay or memoir is uniquely suited for our times, because today our need to pay attention to the singular, idiosyncratic human voice is perhaps more urgent than ever before. That was a couple of years ago, but obviously I'd say you still feel the same way.
Yes, I do. Almost all of literature is the singular human voice, and poetry, fiction, drama, mm-hmm. the three traditionally known as the three literary genres,
yes.
Never really have to defend that. Essayists and memoirists tend to have to defend it, mainly because mm-hmm. poets and fiction writers and playwrights aren't always interested in calling the essay or the memoir or mm-hmm. what we call creative nonfiction a literary genre. And I feel in the last 10 or 15 years, that conversation has been prominent, not just here, but really all over the world. Someone from Australia called me up to interview me about creative nonfiction about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. And she knew as much or more about it in terms of its literary value than, mm-hmm. you know, anyone I've talked to. So I think people are, I don't know if they're changing their mind. The essay was as legitimate a literary form as there was when Montaigne mm-hmm. was writing in the 16th century. And it really goes all the way back to the rhetoricians, the Romans, and maybe back to people who, you know, wrote on cave walls. It's the singular first person. Scott Russell Sanders, who is a wonderful personal mm-hmm. essay, I don't think he coined the term, but it's the title of an essay he wrote on the personal essay. And it really is singular in the sense that you're mining your own experience, you're mining your own really imagination. Mm-hmm. But when you talked earlier about the story being, you know, a transformation from yes. being one kind of kid to another kind of kid, that's really what we do when we write. Mm-hmm. We try to take the materials, in our case, essays and memoirs of our own experience, what's going on in our minds, the things we observe, all of it, and transform it into something called an essay or a memoir mm-hmm. or a piece of literary journalism or cultural criticism. It's in the transformation that the literature the literary voice is heard, mm-hmm. and literature is made. And I don't think that the process is a lot different than what poets and certainly lyric poets know mm-hmm. exactly what that is. And first-person fiction writers doing by getting in the heads of characters mm-hmm. who are a representation, certain, maybe not of the author, but a persona of one sort or another. And I think that essayists and memoirs have to do pretty much the same thing. Otherwise, your story becomes, and this happened to me, and then this, and then this, mm-hmm. and then yes. It isn't interesting. It is just mm-hmm. a, you know, another coming of age story.
Well, in the premiere issue of For Genre, you wrote about whether or not memoirs are obligated to tell the whole truth. And then in that article, you excerpted a previously published essay about a run-in with your high school coach, and that's now a passage and still pitching. At the time you wrote that original essay, you said that it was due in part to some professional conflicts you were having as a 50-something professor. So I'm wondering what in your life led you to write an entire book about your adolescence.
It was not planned.
Okay.
By the time I got around to tackling a memoir to an essayist is the full-length work, mm-hmm. the way a novel is to a fiction writer who writes short stories. And originally, I wanted to write, first it was a collection of essays that mm-hmm. were loosely connected by the fact that they happen at a certain period in time, and a lot of them were about sports and growing up, but mm-hmm. there were other things in that collection. And then an agent advised me to turn this into a full-length memoir. And I thought about it for a long time because it took a few years to piece the collection together. And I don't know if he was right or not, but his advice sounded right to me. Mm-hmm. And so I took apart the whole collection and looked at it as a whole, and what I seemed to find or wanted to find anyway was a connection between being a baseball player when I was a kid mm-hmm. and becoming a writer. I think in a funny way, every writer who writes a memoir, whether it's about writing or it isn't, mm-hmm. in some ways is dealing with the influences that shaped him or her into being one. I was going to do it explicitly. I thought it was an interesting connection, mm-hmm. and especially being a relief pitcher in high school and in college and way beyond, I really learned that I had to finish every game. If yeah. I didn't, I'd be out there at the end whether I won or I lost, but I got in the habit mm-hmm. of finishing it. When we write memoir, we write our own mythology, and mm-hmm. mine is that maybe that piece of my life is what taught me how to complete most everything that mattered to me. Yeah. You know, a doctoral dissertation when I really wasn't sure I wanted mm-hmm. to complete it. And almost every writing project I've ever taken on mm-hmm. that I invested myself in seriously, I finished, yeah. for better or worse. And in the end, writers are really people who finished. Mm-hmm.
Well, baseball taught you tenacity, self-discipline.
It would seem so. Mm-hmm. And in making that connection, mm-hmm. I was looking at a very large narrative arc, you know, from mm-hmm. being a kid to being a writer. It's 40-something years. Yeah. And the book would probably have come out that way, but I started to feel as I was writing it that arc was determining not just the shape of the book, but the things I had to put in. And they, mm-hmm. things weren't coming to me organically in the way that I think they ought to when you're writing. And instead of being able to write into scenes and states of mind, I found myself having to summarize a lot to get from one point to another. And that's yeah. a little bit more like a story, and I don't think memoir is a story. And so two things happen. One, I gave myself permission to go back into the childhood section, mm-hmm. which is a section I didn't want to write because, again, I thought, I'm too old to... No, it's never painful.
It's just memory.
No, it's never painful. It's exhilarating to write, okay. no matter what you write about. even the painful parts, it's writing. You're doing something different than reliving those, although you relive them. You're actually crafting them into something that it certainly isn't going to redeem them, but it's going to make sense out of them. And that, to me, there's nothing much more satisfying than that. And so when I went back into the childhood stuff, I learned two things. One, this adult narrator, me, wasn't going to be able to write this book authoritatively until he understood who that kid was.
Okay.
And not so much as a person in the real world, but as a character in his book.
Mm-hmm.
Once I understood how that kid thought and felt and got through the things he got through, it would have been much easier for me to authoritatively move to the young adult, to the, finally to the midlife adult. And I realized, too, what my editor had been telling me all along. She kept saying, Mike, dig deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a good scene now. Write them like this. And I knew what she meant because it's what I tell all my students, but because I had that long arc, it was prohibiting doing that. You couldn't go in depth. So when I realized that, one, those shaping influences were in those 10 years, and they are for all of us in one way or another in our childhood and adolescence. It could come from family, it could come from outside influences, it come from anywhere. But what we locate as those shaping influences, that becomes a story that we tell ourselves the rest of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wrote a memoir about growing up in New York, and I really didn't spend a lot of time writing about my family.
No.
I wrote about my coaches.
Yes.
Well, in reality, my family was more prominent in my day-to-day life, but the urgency seemed to be in that obsession with baseball and that drive and in wanting that. And so I had to sweep all those other things away. But what I also found out was, in looking at the long manuscript, the adult looking back on the child was the richest part of the writing. And if I could cut everything else away, I'd be left with a piece of childhood, which really is enough for a memoir. But I'm not an inexperienced writer.
Mm-hmm.
I had to tell myself that, and I teach it to myself again. And it took 2.5 years to find the book that needed to be written, even though I was writing another one.
Mm-hmm.
And once I found it, I wrote it more quickly and with more rhythm and concentration than anything I've ever done. It took me only 7 months to complete it. And I was only left with 50 pages of the original 300-page manuscript, and this one's 300. And in the end, even though it's just childhood, whoever had to pick the book up and read it and summarize it for the jacket copy said, this is a story about how a boy who was a baseball player made himself into a writer.
Yeah.
So the implication was there all the time, and it just reinforces.
Achieved what you set out to do.
Right. It just reinforces what I think. It's that singular first person again. It's the details, the universe in a grain of sand. People will make more out of what you write in some ways than you will. They'll see a larger picture than you will. And you have to trust that story is the one that needs to be told.
Mm-hmm.
And once I let go of the big one, this became fun to do.
Good. Well, speaking of your coaches, do you know whatever happened to Tom Sullivan, coach of your VFW baseball team? Because as I was reading about your run-ins with them, I thought someone that anti-Semitic and cruel would never be a coach today.
Probably not, but then I'm not so sure because of all the abuse scandals we're seeing with the church. And a friend of mine, Richard Hoffman, wrote a memoir 5-7 years ago called Half the House about being, sexually molested by a baseball coach.
Oh.
In his youth. The coach who was implicated was still coaching when Richard wrote the book.
My gosh.
I mean, when the book came out, the coach was implicated, arrested. Ultimately, he committed suicide in prison, for which, the writer has to think about, for the rest of his life. But I think in the main, yes, you're right. All coaches when I was a kid were kind of like those coaches because they could get away with it. Today, it's a lot harder to get away with, but then there's a whole generation of people who, you know, played under those coaches, just like the boys who became adults, you know, are blowing the whistle on priests. Coaches now have to look at a different reality for themselves. But I'm still not certain that coaches still don't push kids a lot harder and a lot further than we imagine.
It's kind of frightening to think about.
Well, yes.
At the end of your epilogue, you wrote that in, quote, some perverse way, unquote, Coach Kirchman, who was your high school baseball coach, gave you what you had been asking for all along, a nod of acceptance from one kind of Jew to another. Now, Kirchman was from a hard Scrabble blue-collar background, and you were middle class. But do you think that ultimately you received genuine acceptance from the upper crust privileged Jews you grew up with, like Ronnie Zeidner and Rob Brownstein?
No. I think that's a different dynamic.
Okay.
I was always fascinated with that world. When I was doing my work on my doctorate, the person I picked to work on was F. Scott Fitzgerald, who had the same fascination with the very rich, because they lived and breathed a different atmosphere than we did. I'm still fascinated with that strata of life. I think it was easier to earn the acceptance of someone like my coach, who we were sort of operating, we're trying to accomplish the same thing. I thought he at least made a pass at trying to teach his players something, as hard as he was, as abusive as he might have been construed to be, although when I was a kid I didn't think of it that way at all.
Yeah.
I just thought of it as somebody pushing me. You know, this is an urban childhood.
Well, you almost quit. I mean, did quit. You didn't intend to.
You always do, but it's not something I was unused to as a kid. This is what it was like when you went out in the streets. It wasn't... You pushed your way through everything. Junior high was like that. Everything was like that. But the other coach who you mentioned, Sullivan, no, I don't know what became of him. I do know what became of Kirchman. He's still alive. I saw him 5 years ago. And I may hear from him again soon, because the word has got getting back on this book from a lot of people who I went to high school with. Sullivan, I don't know where he is. I don't know anything about what happened to him after he passed my radar screen. I never looked back at him. That was I had one summer where I had a play with for him, and it was confrontational in every way. But Kirchman was a force in my development for 4 years, and I had to keep dealing with him all the time. With Sullivan, once I settled it with him, that was it. And that's pretty much the way, that's the law of the streets. You know, if you push the bully back, then generally the bully backs off and you get some respect. And
well, I loved how you stood up to him
on
pitcher's mound and threw the ball at his head.
There was no choice, and I never imagined myself to, I never imagined I was capable of doing anything like
yourself.
That and how. Yeah. I even surprised myself when I was writing it again. When I got to that scene where I actually took the ball and aimed it at his head, I said, something's going to happen. The ball isn't going to hit him, because this guy who's throwing it just couldn't do that. He never would do it. But, of course, you know, it did because it did. And there was no avoiding it. So.
Well, I have a few lighter questions now about your book. As I was reading, I sometimes felt that I needed a baseball glossary at hand. What, for instance, is a fungo?
Oh, a fungo is... there's a thin baseball bat that it's almost, you know, a big version of a broomstick. It's fatter.
Oh, okay.
And it's made for hitting fly balls to outfielders, coach uses that bat. It's called a fungo bat because catching fly balls in the outfield in pregame warm-up is called fielding fungos.
Oh, okay.
And it's just, again, part of the language of the game and the lore of the game, which is one reason I started getting fascinated with it anyway. I love the language.
The language.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, did you ever forgive your mother for throwing out your baseball cards and other sports memorabilia?
I don't think any kid ever does, and it's every kid's story, and I'm not sure why it's every kid's story.
It's universal.
In a weird way, it is. Almost everyone I know who saved those things, somebody threw them out. My mother had good reason. They were leaving, and there's nothing that they could take. They're going to California. But, of course, nobody knew what those things were going to be worth when we became adults. I mean, there's no such thing as memorabilia when I was a kid. Now it's an industry. But I bet I wouldn't have sold any of it, knowing me. And not because I'm even sentimental or nostalgic. I'm just a pack rat. I hang on to everything.
Okay. Well, you really haven't attended a Major League Baseball game in 40 years?
Well, I have now.
Oh, you have?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
When I was writing the book, well, it wasn't 40 years. Did I say 40
years?
Well,
it was something like you went to the Polo Grounds when the Mets first started playing, but once Shea Stadium was built, that was it.
I stopped. Well, but I went...
After Ebbets Field was demolished, too, said you wouldn't go to another
game. In the books that I cut away from this book, I went a lot to Tiger Stadium for a while.
Oh, okay.
And then also a good friend of mine at Michigan State pitched for the Los Angeles Dodgers and many, many other teams in the 70s. And so he took me to games, and so I went with him. I didn't have any real emotional connection to the game, and as soon as the dome stadiums and, you know, fields of plastic grass and suburbs became de rigueur, I really lost interest in the game. But it wasn't only because of that. It was because I was older and I had other things that were on my mind.
Sure.
I have gone a couple of times in the last few years, but just like I said about going to Shea Stadium, I feel like I'm kind of there as a tourist. I don't have the passion for it. I'm not an aficionado the way I was as a kid. But put me in a library, you know, again, your passions shift and, you know.
Sure. Well, in 2000, the MSU Press published Peninsula, Essays and Memoirs from Michigan, which you edited. And I know your friend Bob Root, who I had the pleasure of interviewing a couple of years ago, suggested such a work in the first place. But your contribution to the collection was Dream Expatriate, a meditation on memory and place. And it's in it, you're rather down on East Lansing. It's just a generic college town. But you love the Leelanau Peninsula and your cottage up in Northport. But overall, what do you think living in Michigan has really contributed to your writing?
Absolutely. A writer always needs something to push against. Place is a very significant part of, well, not just any writer, but any human being's sense of identity, sense of self. And then, you know, as a memoirist, an essayist, these are things you write about. These are things you think about. Having grown up in New York and lived in places like Los Angeles and Chicago, and coming to the Midwest, it was culture shock, certainly, and it didn't matter if it was the 60s or now. Friends from urban areas still think the same way, not necessarily about East Lansing or Michigan, but an urban existence is so different than living in a college town or living in a small town or living in an area that's surrounded by farms. Also, the point of view is much different. People are people everywhere, but place... I don't think any of us ever really outrun the places where we were born, where we were raised, because that's where, again, that's where our formative influences were. That's where our roots are. And I like writing about place. Still pitching is as much about places as it is about anything else. And Peninsula is, too, because it's a place that I never really felt at home in. That's why Bob said, you're the one who should do this book, because as someone who... is not connected emotionally to Michigan, your observances will qualify you to be an editor. But as I said in the book, after having read all the things that the writers gave me, I had a much different appreciation of Michigan, which is the way I think we all are when it comes to seeing something that's been transformed for us by someone else. And so I still don't feel at home here, but I don't think it's Michigan anymore. Mm-hmm. I think it's the nature of who I am.
Okay.
I think that I portray myself in Still Pitching as a congenital outsider.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it's real. I think part of it's true, just because you select certain things in life, being mm-hmm. a writer, being a teacher, being a college teacher, loving books. There are a lot of people who do, but the majority of the population doesn't.
Yeah.
So you are always on the fringes. Being an essayist and a memoirist, you're on the fringe of a genre conversation that, doesn't always open doors to you. So it's either something I gravitate toward or something that I feel somehow has become a part of me. And so sometimes, as a New Yorker, you just fetch too much. And I like that.
Yeah.
And it's become, it's like Woody Allen,
yes.
It's part of him. And so I think that I've taken on that kind of persona as a writer, certainly as mm-hmm. a writer. As a human being, it's like anything else. There are moments when you're in love with where you are, and there are moments when you feel just, alien. And I mm-hmm. just think that's more, the normal swing of being a human being.
Yeah.
But I really don't think New Yorkers adjust that well.
Okay.
When they're out of New York.
Fair enough. Well, lastly, and we'll wrap this up, what writing are you currently working on?
I gave myself a year off.
Oh, okay.
And when I completed this book, I've been working on a big project, one book or another, and the journal, to me, which is the equivalent mm-hmm. of an anthology every time we put it out. Big projects have dominated the last 10 years. I really almost stopped a normal life mm-hmm. for 10 years to get these books in the world, because these were things I really wanted to write. And I knew if I didn't write them now, I wasn't going to do it, or the years would pass me by, or something could happen. And so having done, in a way, the memoir was a way of kind of finishing a whole period. And when it was finished, I said, I'm going to give myself a year to enjoy this memoir, to take it out, to read, mm-hmm. to talk to people, to,
And you're getting plenty
reconnect.
Of that done.
And I'm getting it done, and
good.
It's been really fun. And the year is almost up,
mm-hmm.
and there are at least, dozens of little slips of paper on my desk for things that might come next.
Okay.
But not knowing what comes next is something that is very atypical of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like that feeling, because I know...
you're entitled.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is an entitlement. You let yourself get... You let yourself take something in that you feel
mm-hmm.
you feel good about. And so when I start up again, I'm not really worried that there won't be other things there, because the writing for me is like oxygen. It's breathing air.
Yeah.
I almost can't not write. Right now I'm occupied with other things, but the minute that stops, the itch will be there. It always has been. So
well, good luck with your future endeavors. Good luck with promoting
Thanks.
The book. And thank you very much, Dr. Steinberg, for participating in the Michigan Writer Series.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.